You're listening to the Hog Sports Network Daily Podcast. Now, here's your host, Matt Jones.
On today's show, Patrick Ebert from D1Baseball.com joins us to talk about Kansas, Creighton, and North Dakota State at the Fayetteville Regional that begins Friday over at Baum Walker Stadium. We'll also be joined by Christina Long from Destin, Florida. She's down there for the SEC Spring Meetings. She'll tell us everything that's being discussed between SEC leaders. But first, a word from Kendall King.
At Kendall King, we're proud of over four decades of design. We're continuing the legacy of great creative design by combining our brands of Kendall King, Soapbox, and ShopCart. Together, these brands represent a new focus in marketing design with individual attention to specific areas. Through our design expertise supported by a team of talented professionals, we showcase our best. We are Kendall King, we are Soapbox, we are ShopCart, we are design.
Joined now by Patrick Ebert. He works for D1Baseball.com, covers baseball throughout the Midwest, and so we thought he'd be great to have to talk about these three Midwest teams that are coming to Arkansas this week: Kansas, Creighton, and North Dakota State at the Fayetteville Regional. Patrick, when you saw this draw that Arkansas had, I wonder what you think about the other teams in this field.
Yeah, I think the first thing that stands out is just Kansas, and Kansas is a team that I believe they're making their seventh, you know, postseason appearance, but and with every game they won this year, it seemed like they were breaking a previous program record. And, you know, to be 43-15 right now, you know, this is essentially the greatest season that the Jayhawks have ever enjoyed for their baseball club. And, you know, their head coach, Dan Fitzgerald, came on board, you know, a talented recruiter in the SEC, definitely, you know, earned his chops, you know, with the teams that he built along the way. And he's doing the same thing now with Kansas, and still hasn't gotten like a full recruiting cycle under his belt, bringing in transfers, bringing in JUCO guys to build that club. But yeah, Kansas is, you know, I saw them earlier this year play Minnesota in a midweek game up in Minneapolis, and you know, they're tough. They're gonna battle you out, you know, for a full nine innings. They got a deep pitching staff, and I mean, yeah, it's just you don't know what you're gonna get with them because of the 10 series that they played. They either swept or were swept in seven of them. So it's very much an up-and-down kind of team. But when they win in bunches.
Creighton seems like a team that can pitch. I mean, I know their pitching numbers are really good. I would suspect playing in that ballpark probably helps out, you know, with those pitching numbers a little bit. But just that team and with it being Ed Services last year, I wonder what you see from them.
Yeah, I mean, you hit the nail on the head. It's their pitching staff that's been their most successful component. They have three really good weekend starters, but kind of a staple of Ed Services teams over the year has been the strength of their bullpen and their defense. The defense isn't quite as special this year as has been in past years, but the bullpen is really special. And Matthew Alkerman and Garrett Langrell gives them a pair of just lights out arms from the bullpen. Garrett Langrell is like a 6'7" right-hander that comes like sidearm at you, like low 90s with a pretty good slider, and that definitely creates some serious mismatch problems for opposing hitters, regardless of what team they face. But yeah, you know, it's interesting too with their starting staff. You know, like just take their Friday guy, Dominic Cancellari. You know, he's made 12 starts this year, but he's only thrown 51 innings. So, you know, they'll go 4, 5, 6 innings with their starters, and then go to their bullpen and use a pretty robust collection of arms to get through games.
North Dakota State, they've got the worst record in the entire postseason field. They're 20-32, but they won the Summit League. I think St. Thomas, they were ineligible to play in the conference tournament. Correct me if I'm wrong, but they were the co-conference champions. And they're still in a transition period there from Division II. This team, I mean, what are the strengths? And obviously there's weaknesses when you've got a record like that. But what can Arkansas expect from North Dakota State on Friday?
You know, North Dakota State, they're battle-tested. They opened the year and they played Dallas Baptist, Lamar, UTRGV, Alabama, LSU, and Tulane to open the year. And they only won two of those games. So they got off to a really rough start. Their non-conference schedule and overall record was not good. But then as soon as Summit League played, they played Oral Roberts in Tulsa, and they won that series. And if you follow Summit League baseball, you know that Oral Roberts is – been the standard in that league for a long time. But this is now North Dakota State's second postseason appearance, I believe, in the last 4 or 5 years. And a lot of their success comes with their pitching staff. And they had the Summit League Pitcher of the Year in left-hander Nolan Johnson. Doesn't throw especially hard, but he gets through innings, you know, and he misses bats and he limits walks and he does all those things you expect from a from an upper 80s left-hander that enjoys success as he does. But it's a fairly deep staff, and their overall ERA is just over 6. But there's several arms that can get them through some key innings. And their offense mainly is a line drive base attack. And, you know, they're going to steal some bases, but it's going to be a motion-based offense.
It seems like it's always a surprise. I mean, you mentioned ORU. We're real familiar with them here. It's the closest Division I program to Fayetteville. They play the Razorbacks quite a bit. And it seems like Arkansas and ORU see each other a lot in the postseason. It's always a surprise, I feel like, when they don't win the Summit League, because they win it so often and they get to the tournament so often. What do you think North Dakota State did well to be able to take that throne from them this year?
They pitched. I mean, you look at those four Summit League championship games that they played, and you know the first game was a 1-0 win in 10 innings over Omaha, and then their next three games were all against Oral Roberts. The first was another shutout. The second was a loss, and the third was a 4-2 win. So to beat those games, you got to pitch well, right? And all four of those games were played in Omaha. You know, the University of Nebraska Omaha hosted the Summit League Championship. But that's the problem, you know, when you're a one seed like Arkansas and you bring in that four seed and you have a pitcher of the year that's going to be going in that first game. You know, that's the danger of those 1-4 matchups when you have a team like North Dakota State that is battle-tested, that tested themselves and challenged themselves really hard early in the year. So, you know, when they come down to Fayetteville, they're not going to be daunted by the challenge that faces them. And it starts with their starting pitcher and Nolan Johnson. And that's a tough matchup.
You mentioned he didn't throw real hard. What does he do well?
He mixes well between a fastball and a changeup, and the fastball averages, I believe, 88 miles per hour, but the changeup is the real separator. And anytime you have a left-hander like that can command their fastball on the inner half of the plate against left-handed hitters and then use that changeup effectively to that same arm side part of the plate against right-handed hitters, you can have a guy that has a lot of success predominantly throwing those two pitches. So I think the key for Arkansas, obviously, is to be able to recognize those two pitches and, you know, try to get them to throw one over the heart of the plate. I mean, that's always the key, right? Like, is to try to get an opposing pitcher to throw a fastball over the heart of the plate. But to do so, they're going to have to lay off that changeup.
I was talking to somebody about KU yesterday who had seen them play some this year in person, and they said this is a team that's got just a lot of a fight and a lot of grit to them, a lot of old, you know, junior college players who've come out of that Kansas JUCO circuit and ended up there in Lawrence. I wonder how much you've seen that from them this year, just, you know, a team that's got that kind of dirtbag mentality that is hard to put away late in games.
Yeah, that's stated well. They have the overall kind of persona of their head coach. I mentioned Dan Fitzgerald before, who's just a really talent evaluator, you know, just from his ability to build a program. But, you know, like you take someone like first baseman Brady Bollinger, who was a JUCO transfer, came in and batted .363 with 16 home runs and just had a huge season. Jackson Haugie, their right fielder, came in from Minnesota State. He actually didn't play last year due to injury. But he comes down there and leads the team in home runs with 19. You know, I mentioned the series up in Minneapolis earlier. They hit 5 home runs in a row in one of those two games. And just so they went back to back to back to back to back. And just that gives you an idea of just the kind of like emotion and the momentum that they build on their team and within their program. And their starting staff, too. I mean, Dominic Vegele, the numbers may not show it. He's got a 5.34 ERA, but this is the Big 12 Freshman of the Year a season ago, and he can go toe-to-toe with any ace that there is. Cooper Moore, their Saturday guy, gives them the second starter, actually has better overall numbers. But then the reliever that they like to get the ball to is Alex Breckheimer, and he's a guy that gives them a lot of innings. He's taken the ball 32 times this year, which gives you an idea of just how often he's pitched, has 7 saves, been really effective. But, yeah, this is definitely a team that's going to wear you out.
I was looking, Patrick, on Monday. You've got the selection committee's rankings come out, and you got new polls that come out. Not everybody updated their polls Monday, but the ones that did. And just the difference in opinion from everybody. Like, you know, North Carolina's number one in the coaches poll, but they're number five by the selection committee. Or Vanderbilt's one in the committee, and they're four in the rankings. It's just there seems to be no consensus this year as to, you know, who the best teams are nationally. And it feels like this tournament's so wide open because of that. I wonder what your thoughts are on just – it seems like there's a real uniqueness about this year in that somebody hasn't stepped up and said, hey, I'm the team to beat.
Yeah, I think it's a great observation. Early in the year, we thought Tennessee was that team, right? Like, they looked unbeatable, and then suddenly they weren't, they were beatable. And they their second half stretch, they were still very good. You know, they're obviously hosting a regional. But that number one spot at the top of the rankings, like you mentioned, shuffled in and out a lot of different teams. You mentioned, you know, North Carolina, Vanderbilt, LSU. I mean, Arkansas is right in that mix. Tennessee, Texas. And what I think we're really seeing is that transfer portal is creating parity at the top. So I don't think you have parity throughout. So I think you have parity amongst like the top 10, 15, maybe 20 teams that are all pretty loaded. But to your point, I don't think there's a lot that differentiates them from one team to the next. And that is where I think we could see a real competitive postseason. I'm not so sure that we're going to see a lot of like Cinderella stories. Like, you know, I don't know if we're going to see that Coastal Carolina, although Coastal Carolina is very good this year, or, you know, say like Dallas Baptist or one of those mid-major powers. Southern Miss would be another one. I'm not sure if we're going to see them advance, simply because I do think those teams at the top are so powerful. But like I mentioned, I don't think you can really distinguish what makes one team so much better than the other when you're talking about the top teams in the SEC and the ACC.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it just kind of feels like anybody can win it and anybody could lose it in a regional.
Yeah.
Arkansas, I wonder what your thoughts have been watching them from afar.
You know, I was there last year when Kansas State beat them at the Fayetteville Regional. Mm-hmm. I covered them also at the Stillwater Regional, I believe, in 2022. So I've seen them good and I've seen them bad. And really it comes down to, as you well know, when Arkansas plays well, they're one of the most dangerous teams in the country. You know, having the Aloy brothers, a pair of transfers in that lineup makes them especially dangerous. But really what it comes down to year after year, time after time, is the pitching staff. And, you know, Zach Root needs to be right. You know, you need to get good outings from Gabe Gackle and Landon Beetlesheese and guys like that. Those guys need to have strong regional performances. They can't get ahead of themselves. And to be honest, you know, when I saw this regional, when I saw Kansas heading down to Fayetteville, the first thing I thought of was last year when they got Kansas State in that draw. Mm-hmm. Kansas State got hot at the right time, took that regional, you know, and obviously the rest is history. So Arkansas needs to be mindful. I guarantee you they haven't forgotten about that. It's probably going to allow them to play with a little added chip on their shoulder. I think Arkansas is truly one of the most complete teams. And then when you talk about like the D1 staff, when we talk about these teams and you know our projected favorites, you just got to believe one of these years Arkansas is going to break through, because they've been one of the most consistently dominant teams in all of college baseball.
Well, you mentioned you were here last year, and after Arkansas lost to SEMO in the regional and got eliminated, you heard Dave Van Horn talk about, we've got to change the look of this lineup. Got to get more athletic, better athletes, can't be so reliant upon the home run. I wonder how much different they look to you this year versus what you saw here a year ago.
Yeah, you know, obviously these teams turn over really quickly. And head coach Dave Van Horn, after that SEMO loss, even pointed out that, you know, they had a couple challenges on the recruiting trail. You know, they had some high school kids that they thought they were going to get and that ended up going into the draft and taking their talents to the professional level. And they had a couple transfers that they thought that they were going to secure that didn't come to be. Now, even with that, they still had a very talented lineup and you know, you're going to have to help me with the pronunciation of their shortstop's first name, but, you know, the Loy, what is it?
Vahiva.
Wahiwa?
Vahiva.
Wahiwa, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't even know if I can say that.
The double user Vs.
Vahiva, okay, got it. That's a good way to remember that. but, yeah, I mean, he was on the team last year, but he's changed a lot as a hitter. He still struck out 55 times this year, But I saw him in the Cape last summer, and he was swinging a lot at breaking balls away. And just from watching him more, thanks to things like ESPN Plus and the SEC Network, I've seen that he's really improved his approach. He's not flailing at those breaking balls away as much, and that's a sign of his own maturation as a hitter and an overall player. And I think when you have that overall as a team, who's with your offense is all, you know, significantly better, you're hitting over 300 as a team, you have over 100 home runs as a team, and you're playing excellent defense as usual, you know, as you come to expect at Arkansas, you know, you're not going to look past this offense. And if they end up losing this regional, it's not going to be because they didn't have the talent, right? It's going to be that they didn't execute when they needed to execute, and they just didn't flat out produce.
You beat me to the punch on being in Stillwater a few years ago. I remember seeing you there and talking to you. Just what are your memories of that regional, and have you ever seen anything crazier in one weekend of college baseball?
No, I think my neck still hurts from that regional. I mean, seriously, there was so much offense. I will never forget Grand Slam. And again, was it Jalen Battles, yes, was the shortstop's name, yeah, at the time? That Grand Slam on Saturday night. To put them up by, I think at the time, like 6 runs. It was something like 18-12 or something at that point in time. They took that lead over Oklahoma State, and it was just nuts, you know, because the next day Oklahoma State won 2 games, you know, again, just on sheer offense. I believe who they beat, Missouri State, and mm-hmm. then Arkansas on Sunday night to advance to Monday's championship game, which was a well-played game by both teams, you know, good pitching, good defense, good hitting. And not ridiculous scoring, but yeah, that regional will always be remembered by me as one of the craziest I've ever seen. The very next weekend, I was in Knoxville to watch Notre Dame upset Tennessee, which at that time Tennessee is probably the most dominant college baseball team I've ever seen. That 2022 team, and they didn't even make it to the College World Series. So that postseason for me was especially memorable.
Yeah, it was a crazy year. That's your Ole Miss won it. Arkansas got to the semifinals. It was a lot of fun to watch. Patrick, we appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Okay, thank you. Patrick Ebert from D1Baseball.com. When we come back, Christina Long will join us from the SEC Spring Meetings in Destin. But first, a word from Kendall King.
At Kendall King, we're proud of over 4 decades of design. We're continuing the legacy of great creative design by combining our brands of Kendall King, Soapbox, and ShopCart. Together, these brands represent a new focus in marketing design with individual attention to specific areas. Through our design expertise supported by a team of talented professionals, we showcase our best. We are Kendall King. We are Soapbox. We are ShopCart. We are design.
Hey, welcome back. I want to tell you about our friends at Bentonville Glass. They've been serving their community since 1971, committed, professional, versatile. If you're looking for a quality leader in Northwest Arkansas or looking for skilled craftsmanship, look no further than Bentonville Glass for all your glass market needs with the highest quality products. You can come by and see them now at 507 South Main in Bentonville or online at BentonvilleGlass.com. I want to tell you, too, you can get the latest breaking news on all Razorback sports at WholeHogSports.com. Most in-depth source for all Arkansas sports. It's analysis, latest in recruiting, unique stories on all your favorite teams. Subscribe today at WholeHogSports.com. Christina Long, who works with us, is in Destin this morning, and she's at SEC Spring Meetings. If you don't know what SEC Spring Meetings are, this is it's an annual meeting, Memorial Day week every year. All the SEC ADs, the football coaches, the men's and women's basketball coaches, and eventually the chancellors and presidents show up to vote on things at the end of the week. They debate, I don't know, maybe the meaning of life down there in Destin, but they get together, talk about college football playoff. Is the SEC going to go to 9-game schedule? Seems like that's been on the docket for about 5 years now. And a lot of different matters trying to push the conference forward. And Christina's there covering that for us. Christina, have they figured out a playoff format yet?
They haven't. And it's so funny because it feels like everything, all these big issues we're talking about with the House settlement, with 9 or 8 or 9 games, with the college football playoff, so much of it is being discussed. And it's important for them to discuss it together while they have the time. But not a lot of it is of that big stuff is actually going to be decided on this week, because a lot of it happens, you know, outside of the SEC. A lot of it is dependent on the House settlement, which could be approved or denied any day now. We don't know when that's going to happen. And so especially with the 8 or 9 games discussion, which is a big one that's specific to the SEC. That's one that they could, in theory, decide on this week. They're probably not going to, because they need to wait and see what's going to happen with the playoff. And we don't know yet when that's going to happen. It has to be sometime this year, but it doesn't have to be this week.
Doesn't it feel like a little bit like a, I don't know if chicken and egg is right, but I mean, it's like the playoffs waiting on the SEC to go to 9 games, and the SEC is waiting on the playoff to expand before they expand their conference schedule. It almost feels like there's just a little bit of an impasse right there, and I wonder how they get past that.
Right. It's about the expansion, and it's also about these auto bids, because whether or not they get these 4 auto bids that the Big Ten and SEC reportedly want, although Greg Sankey says that they have not committed to a model, there is not a model that the SEC is really pushing for. While they are still kind of trying to figure that out, that's what's going to really dictate what the SEC wants to do as far as 8 or 9 games. And, you know, there's also with that discussion of how do we change SEC championship game weekend? Should we change it? Should we make it where the 2 and 3 teams play, mm-hmm. you know, to keep the number one team, you know, sort of safe, I guess, before the playoff. But that's something that I don't think they're going to decide this week either, but it's something that coaches are discussing and administrators are discussing. And it's another thing that, you know, so much of this is that we have so many related issues all kind of happening at the same time, and all of them are kind of dependent on each other, because then you also have things that are dependent on the House settlement. And so there's so much different, there's so many different topics that all are kind of overlapping. And like you said, it's chicken and egg. You have to see what has to come first is kind of confusing. And what has to happen first for other decisions to get made is one of the harder things about all of this that's going on.
Well, and then there's also the television angle. I mean, ESPN, they want the SEC to play more SEC versus SEC games, and ESPN doesn't want the SEC to get rid of playing teams from other power conferences. They, you know, they pay so much money for these television contracts. They want good games. They don't want to see Arkansas playing Alcorn State. They don't want to see Alabama playing Alabama A&M or any of these other, you know, crazy games that you know, you should never see on a college football schedule. And so that's a factor here too.
Exactly. And that's something that Greg Sankey said on his opening day, you know, of remarks, is that he's trying to encourage athletic directors in the league to keep scheduling those hard games, to not cancel games, which we've seen some of these, you know, series get canceled, some games down the road that are, you know, against other power conferences, other power conference teams, they've started kind of canceling them or being concerned about them. And he's trying to encourage them to keep those games, especially for right now, especially while it's kind of in limbo with whether or not the conference is going to go to 8 or 9. But like you said, I mean, TV would love for them to play as hard a schedule as possible, because then you have, you know, these big time games every week. So it's really, there's a lot of factors contributing, and there's a lot of voices in the room. And that's part of what these meetings are for. There's a lot of discussion to be had, and there's, you know, ESPN will present something this week. I can't remember if it's today or tomorrow, but they'll, you know, ESPN and Disney representatives are here to talk about things like that. And so there's a lot of issues kind of on the table that, honestly, what's crazy about it is that, like I said, you might not get decisions on a lot of these things this week.
What's interesting about the SEC is that you've got different programs that are in different, you know, stages of life, so to speak. I mean, you've got the Alabamas and the Georgias and Texas and Tennessee, who those are teams that they're going to be competing for playoffs every year, most likely. And then you've got teams like Arkansas, and I'd probably put Mississippi State in this boat, and some others where, you know, their ideal season might be 8 wins. They'd love to go to the playoff. There's no doubt about it, but I think they probably kind of understand where they fit in the pecking order. And so you don't, I guess you don't get a real unanimous decision on a lot of things, because all of these different ADs and these coaches are coming at these discussions from what fits their program's, you know, goals the best.
And one thing that you have gotten some consensus on among SEC coaches anyway, that I wrote about yesterday on WholeHogSports.com, was the transfer portal. Kirby Smart had a really interesting comment. He was kind of on fire yesterday. He came in and did a podium session. Not every coach will do a full-on media availability where, you know, they're at a podium and we're sitting in, you know, theater seats. But several of the coaches did, and Kirby Smart was one of them. And he was talking about how he feels like the biggest issue on his mind, and this is coming from a guy that's, you know, playing for national championships every, you know, in contention for national championships every year, he was saying that the number one issue that they have to solve right now is the transfer portal. And if it's going to be one window or two, and when it's going to be. And he said that is the most pressing issue that they need to figure out. He felt like it was not being talked about enough as far as, you know, amid all of the settlement things and all the playoff things and all of this that's going on. He was saying this is kind of getting lost in the mix, and this is really important. And one thing that he said was, for him, for his team, for the Georgias, Alabamas, those, that type of caliber of program that you're talking about, it is really hard to go through preparation for your championship run, for your playoff run, while the portal is open for most of December. And he was talking about how miserable that is and how challenging that is for teams like that. And he said that that's an issue that he's raised at meetings like this and, you know, with college football leaders, you know, outside of just the SEC. And he said that he's been told that there's no crying from the yacht. And I thought that was such an interesting line because, like, Arkansas is not on the yacht. They have not been on the yacht. But at the same time, this is an issue that directly affects them, that affects every program. And they've all kind of reached a consensus that they want one portal window and they want it to be in January. And that's something that they, you know, the AFCA, the Coaches Association talked about that in January. They proposed a 10-day window that to happen every year in January as a solution to this. AFCA doesn't actually have the power to make that happen. They can make that recommendation to the powers that can actually enact that change. But it's something that coaches across the country want, and the SEC coaches are really unanimous in that. And Sam Pittman has talked about that before. He's talked about it, I think, for more than a year now, of he wants one window and he would like it to be in January. Now, Kirby said there's a growing group of coaches who would like to have one portal in April or May and do OTAs in June. So then you get some new guys on campus and you do organized team activities like the NFL does in the summer. And the SEC coaches, Greg Sankey, said they do not want that, that they would rather have what we have now with, you know, December and April than have one in April or May, because of just how many issues that could cause with tampering, with, you know, you have guys that didn't, you know, they don't have the opportunity to transfer after the season. And then they have to go through spring ball knowing that they want to transfer. So they're just going to phone it in spring ball or not try. And you're stuck with players that don't want to be there. And so because they didn't have the opportunity to leave before. Plus, like I said, the tampering issue. So the transfer portal thing was really top of mind yesterday after Kirby Smart's comments. You know, all of us media types kind of started asking other coaches and asking Greg Sankey about it. So it became a topic. He achieved his goal of making it something people were talking about more. And we talked about it a lot more after that because it's something that's interesting because of what you mentioned about how there's all these different programs at different levels, but this is something that they actually all feel very strongly about.
And of course, you know, it's all tethered to higher education too. You've got, enrollment periods when students can enroll into classes and times that they can't enroll into classes. And so it's a very complicated, real complicated issue. I want to go back to playoff, because it seems like there's two models that are kind of being kicked around right now, and who knows, there may be a third that's going to come out of left field one day. But there's this, the one you mentioned, the 4-4-2-2-3 or 1-3, a lot of numbers. The four guaranteed spots for the SEC, four guaranteed spots for the Big Ten. Obviously, the other power conferences, they're going to fight that. And there's this other model where you've got five guaranteed spots in the playoffs. And then in a 16-team playoff, you'd have 11 at-large bids. And, you know, one of the things that I read yesterday was that a lot of the coaches said, well, why isn't that good for the SEC? I mean, you could potentially, theoretically, get more SEC teams into the playoff field with that type of model. I mean, think back to last year. Think about all the SEC teams that were in the top 16 to 20 at the end of the season. You could theoretically get more into a 5-11 model than the, I'm going to try to say this again, the 4-4-2-2-1-3.
Exactly. And that was something that Greg Sankey said on the first day that he kind of caught a little bit of flack for, because it kind of, the interpretation was that he was saying, you know, by doing the 4-4-2-2-1 model,
it sounds like you're reading a Powerball number, right? I mean, it really does.
And every time I read it on a page, it looks really funny.
Remember the old collect call, the 10-10-3-2-1? That's what I think of every time I say the 4-4-2-2-1-3.
Yeah, there's a lot of numbers there. And then, you know, the ACC and the Big 12 want 4-4-3-3-1. So then you've got the other numbers. But so it's very funny. And then there's the 5 plus 11. But I think one of the major things that he talked about was the idea that they haven't, the SEC is not married to a specific model yet, and that it's something that they're still wanting to discuss. And that, like you said, the coaches are open to the 5+11. You know, why wouldn't we do that? So there's a lot of discussion about that because the SEC and the Big Ten have so much power in those discussions. And as far as actually making something like that happen, they have a large amount of the voting power and the ability to actually make that happen. And he was pretty upset by the idea that the ACC and the Big 12 said the other day that, you know, that when the playoff decided to adopt straight seeding for this year's 12-team playoff, that they kind of posted, you know, the commissioners stated about, you know, it being good for the game and things like that. And he was upset by the implication that what he is doing is not good for the game, or that he is not concerned with what is good for the game. And that was something that he talked about kind of in his opening day, opening remarks. And so that's been one of the primary topics of conversation is what's going to be best, you know, and what he caught a little bit of flack for the other day too, as in, you know, social media circles, was saying that, oh, the 4-4, you know, the 4 auto bids for the SEC is actually the SEC making a sacrifice because they could be, you know, on average, they could get 5 or more in, which is interesting from the other end of the table where people are saying 4 automatic qualifiers is not fair. He's saying it's actually, you know, a concession on their part to only do 4. So I like the 5+11. I think that makes sense. I'm interested what they'll actually do because, like I said, the SEC and the Big Ten have so much actual sway in these conversations.
Andy Staples, who covers college football, does a great job on 3. He said, quote, "Today was as pissed off as I've seen Greg Sankey in a public setting," whenever he answered that question about good for the game. For Arkansas, what do you think the primary focus is for the Razorback contingent that's there this week?
Yeah, I think a lot of it, they're in an interesting position because, like I said, they are not on the Kirby Smart yacht. They are not, you know, hoping, you know, they're not going to make a playoff run, probably, is what we're thinking, right? I think we can all agree about that as far as this season and the seasons that they're talking about with making all of these changes. So, but what's interesting is Hunter Yurecek is on the selection committee. And Hunter Yurecek is a decision maker who's in rooms like this. And does have a lot of sway in the sport. You know, he's been part of some of these rules committees, these oversight committees, in his career. And so I think for him, it is a little bit different because he is thinking big picture about college football and about the playoff, as well as about his own institution and what's best for Arkansas. And so I think that's something that puts him in kind of a unique position. As far as, you know, coaching wise, I think the transfer portal thing is huge. I think that's something that Sam Pittman will have a lot of thoughts on. You know, I think a lot of the NIL discussion, you know, there's been talks about this kind of NIL, the NIL Go, the Deloitte run sort of policing arm of NIL and kind of determining the value of some of these deals. That's something that's of a big concern for Arkansas. And so I think things like that are the things that are going to affect the everyday life of every program. Obviously, the playoff matters. It matters for college football. It matters for everybody. Mm-hmm. But as far as Arkansas in the immediate present, they are thinking about the things that are like recruiting, like NIL, like the transfer.
Have you hung out with Feinbaum on the beach yet?
That'll be tonight. You can watch Fine Mom at 5:45, and I will be on the set next to the beach. It is the closest I will get to the beach this whole time.
That's always one of my favorite things to do at SEC spring meetings is watch all the different guys or and women, you know, whoever's there, whether it be coaches or reporters or whoever, go out there on Fine Mom's show. It's he lines them up, doesn't he? I mean, it's like 6, 8, 10 people a day.
Right, because there's so many people here and they've got to fill so much of that show. And, you know, he's sitting out there with that beautiful view in the background. You've got to have some people on. So I went and did it last year, and I'll be on there again this afternoon.
When you need to, like, slip a word in there. Like, we need to give you a word. Like you can slip in, and then everybody who's watched our podcast knows that, you know, the this is the word that Christina's slipping
in. Yeah, we'll have to come up with one. Something, nothing too crazy. It can't be, like, you know, asparagus or like something absurd. It would have to be something I could like actually work into conversation.
Oh, sorry. I'm reading a piece of paper here. How about photographers? You think you get photographers in?
I could maybe get photographers in. We'll see. I'm gonna be worried about that now. I'm gonna think about it though. I'm gonna try.
See if you can get photographers in on Feinbaum when you're on there this afternoon.
I'll see. That'll be the code word.
All right. Yeah, it's like your photographers text the hotline. I don't know. Old radio deal. Christina, we appreciate you taking time to come on here.
Yeah, thanks. I'm hoping to get to talk to Sam Pittman and Hunter Yerchek today or tomorrow while we're down here. And so I'll have some more stories on our site.
You can read all of Christina's coverage at wholehogsports.com. Hey, before we get out of here, real quick, want to say congratulations to Bree Ellis. She won last night the USA Softball Collegiate Player of the Year Award over in Oklahoma City at the Women's College World Series. First Razorback to ever win that award. So that's softball's equivalent of the Heisman Trophy. Big deal for Bree Ellis to win that. You can read more about that on our website. Ethan Westerman has a nice story about her on the site this morning. You can come to our website later today. We'll have more Razorback baseball coverage. Tomorrow's a big day. We'll have Bubba Carpenter here in studio previewing the Fayetteville Regional. Also, tomorrow is Media Day at the Fayetteville Regional. We'll get our chance to talk to players and coaches from all four teams. Hope to see you at our website, wholehogsports.com, or on our podcast tomorrow. Have a great day, everybody.